JB dropped to a crouch and peered at the ground.
Looks like there used to be a real blacktop running along here, before whatever blanked out the whole region.
That a real vill?
Looks like it.
JB straightened and wiped his spectacles, easing the scattergun across his shoulders.
We're gonna go in, Ryan?
Guess so. From what we've seen since we left the redoubt, I mean, the gateway, I hate to think what kind of human muties might live there.
Looks graveyard creepy, Dad.
Looks don't hurt you, Dean.
One of the supporting posts had rotted through, leaving the sign hanging slantwise. The paint had faded and weathered away so that it could barely be read. Welcome to Lonesome Gulch, the famous ghost town of the Old West.
Are we in the West? This doesn't look like any part of the West I ever saw.
Nothing makes much sense, does it? Still, we could find some shelter for the evening, then head back to the gateway and make another jump if there's nothing here worth staying for.
There was another sign a little farther on for a parking lot, a yellow arrow pointing to the right, where there was a large bare stretch of what might once have been tarmac, but was now a meadow of rank grass and spiked weeds.
There's something called a company store. Says it's the first stop and the last stop on the visit. Get your ticket there for the ghost town tour.
The weather was as good as it had been since the jump. The mist had lifted, though it still hung below the surrounding peaks, and a few threads of watery sunlight seeped through the leaden clouds. Beyond the store, they could all see a street of ramshackle buildings, some of them without roofs, some with collapsed walls. In the distance, there was a rusting railroad engine that looked like it dated back well into the 19th century, and a few rotting wagons. Doc shook his head.
Upon my soul, this is uncommonly like a return to the days of my youth. Though I would hazard a guess that this place has been reconstructed for the benefit of the tourist industry.
As they reached the first of the buildings, the store, Doc was proved correct. Under fly-smeared glass, there was a notice that contained the history of Lonesome Gulch, explaining how a local historical society had been formed in the mid-1900s to save and recreate the vanishing parts of the National Heritage. Genuine buildings in various states of disrepair had been collected from all over the region and brought together.
So that our children and their children's children might still be able to relish the romance and reality of the days of yore.
JB pushed the door of the store open. Ignoring the handwritten card that announced it was closed, he went in. Ryan leaned cautiously against the wall, half anticipating that the whole place would crumble into sawdust.
I'll stay out and keep watch.
He turned quickly as he thought he saw something moving at the far end of the street, by the old locomotive. It moved in an odd way, part wriggling, part crawling, but he didn't react fast enough to be sure of what it was. It certainly wasn't anything human. The rest of them roamed through the shadowy interior of the store, which looked like it had been simply abandoned around the time of Skydark. Michael found a big display case near the rear of the building.
Look at this. What are these?
He held up a number of small sacks.
Tobacco?
JB untied the whipcord around the top of one of the bags and tipped the contents into his palm. It was fine grains, as black as midnight.
No, blasting powder.
Some candy here. Can I try some, Dad?
Mildred joined Dean. The candy was in narrow sticks, thinner than a finger, about 6 inches long, wrapped in crinkling twists of cellophane paper. They were in different sections, each one described in old-fashioned golden lettering.
Cinnamon and mint, julep and spearmint, saltwater taffy, clove and apple, banana and coconut. Oh, this place brings back my childhood. I see what you mean, Doc.
Can I have some, Dad?
Let's look around the town first, before the light starts to get worse.
Dean ran out to where his father stood outside the door.
Can I go on my own?
The boy hopped from one foot to the other. Ryan smiled and ruffled Dean's shock of black hair.
I guess so, but don't go beyond the main street. And yell if you see anything, all right?
Sure.
The boy ran off.
Yell if you even think that you see anything.
After regrouping outside the store, the group split up. Ryan and Christy crossed over the main street, stepping down off the uneven planking of the boardwalk. JB and Mildred stayed on the same side as the store. Michael and Doc strolled together along the rutted center of the street, pausing to investigate any building that looked particularly interesting to either of them. Christy pointed to a torn poster stuck inside one of the windows of the nearest buildings.
See that? They were going to hold a pack burrow race a month or so after the long winters started. Just where in Deathlands are we?
Lonesome Gulch. Says this was a typical homestead from the late 1800s. Let's take a look.
It was a sodbuster's shotgun shack, with a single hallway and the rooms opening off to one side, a small parlor, then a bedroom with bunks, and finally a tiny kitchen with an iron stove and hand-pumped sink. Everything was rotting. The surfaces were all slightly moist, with a microscopic covering of mold.
I'm amazed this place has stayed here as long as it has. All around's got the flat taste of death and decay. Why don't we go, lover?
It's kind of interesting. Seems to me that the frontier villes in the old, old past weren't all that different to some of the frontier pestles we see nowadays.
The next building, with a shingled roof that had managed to resist the hostile elements, had once been a combination dentist's and doctor's home. Christy paused in the entrance, shuddering and putting a hand to her eyes.
Gaia!
What?
So much pain and misery here.
She stared at a rusted pair of obstetric stirrups, standing in a corner like instruments of torture. Ryan examined some Victorian dental tools in a glass case, brushing away the dust with his fingers, wincing at the shape and size of the implements. He recognized some of them from his own infrequent visits to fang carvers around Deathlands. Doc stood with Michael a few yards farther up the grassy street, staring up at a building with an odd design of a protractor and a pair of compasses carved near the peak of the gable roof.
A Masonic lodge. First one of those that I've seen since being trolled to this dreadful future. Who would ever have thought that such a widely powerful organization could so simply vanish from the face of the earth?
Dean leaned out of the cab of the old locomotive.
Woo, woo! You used to ride in one of these, Doc?
Indeed I did, my boy. Lynchburg to Danville was one of my favorite rides, and Durango up to Silverton, along the Animus. Smoke and cinders is what I remember best.
J.B. and Mildred had stepped into something labeled Carpenter Shop and Morgue. The walls were covered with a display of old tools, mostly disfigured with a patina of rust, their wooden handles long rotted away. There was a coffin on two trestles, its chased brass handles tarnished and hidden under a layer of green verdigris. The lace around the edge of the pillow and the shroud had all yellowed and decayed. Something rattled against the roof, and both of them looked up, J.B.'s finger going to the trigger of his Uzi. But the sound wasn't repeated.
Wouldn't mind spending some time around this place.
He stared up at an embroidered sampler, dated somewhere in the mid-1800s, and bearing a wobbly sewn signature of Esther Wingate. Man cometh forth like a flower and is cut down. He fleeth also as a shadow, and continueth not.
Must be odd for Doc.
Mildred ran a finger along the top of the coffin, wrinkling her face in disgust.
Everything feels kind of sticky.
Yeah, whole atmosphere is double freaked. The fog's coming back in, rolling up from the river.
Doc was in the offices of the Lonesome Gulch Courier, admiring the heavy printing press, while Michael looked at the crumbling remnants of earlier copies of the newspaper, tacked to the lath and plaster walls.
It says here they had some real heavy snow in January 1895. That before your time, Doc?
I was a lad of 12 when the worst storms in the history of the United States struck the eastern seaboard in 1880. 400 or 500 people died in the hurricane winds and monstrous falls of snow. I will remember, in Vermont, where I was then dwelling, that there were banks of snow measured at 50 feet deep. Perilous times, young fellow.
Funny, you know, Doc?
What?
Well, it's like Lonesome Gulch isn't a real place. The old papers talk about a holdup in the bank and a stabbing at the faro tables. Snow, a fire, and stuff like that, but none of it actually mentions where we are.
Passing strange. But much about this region is a deal more than passing strange, Master Brother. Mistress Sister, Mistless Twister, Blaster Mother. Oh, damnation! I recollect from my studies such foolish verbal confusion as known as aphasia. An indication of some minor brain damage. Yet that is clearly not true, is it? I said that... What are you looking at?
Dean was leaning out of the starred glass of the side window of the old locomotive, imagining himself flying along steel rails at breathless speed. Then his eyes were caught by something perched on the roof of the stagecoach barn, 50 yards farther up the main drag of Lonesome Gulch. J.B. froze, turning away from the filthy window. Mildred drew her revolver.
What was that?
JB touched a finger to his lips, catfooting toward the front door, blaster at the ready. Ryan had opened the case and removed a fearsome pair of chromed forceps with jagged teeth, clicking them in his right hand as he lurched in toward Christy, shoulder hunched to make him look more frightening.
Don't worry, my dear. This will hurt you far more than it will.
Huh. He stopped, putting the instrument silently on the oilcloth-covered couch. Christy had already drawn her Smith & Wesson 640, looking out into the street.
What?
Ryan shrugged. They both heard something, a disturbance in the air, a noise that might have been a cry. But it hadn't sounded like it came from the throat of any creature either of them had ever known. And on the roof, they could definitely hear something. Moving with incredible lightness for such a big, powerful man, Ryan eased his way to the doorway and looked out.
Fire blast!
Abe had spent some years of his life as one of the best gunners on Warwag 1. Abe's past life was shrouded in mystery. Over the years, he told so many different stories to so many different people that he'd honestly lost touch with the truth. But the best times had been riding with the traitor. There wasn't a pest hole from Portland, Oregon to Portland, Maine, where they didn't know the traitor. A grizzled man with a heart of granite and eyes of frozen jet. They knew him, and they feared him. There wasn't a gaudy owner, slut, or hired gun in Deathlands who wasn't aware of the reputation of the traitor with his hacking cough and his battered armalite. When Traitor had walked away, Abe was the last person to see him, watching the rangy figure as it disappeared into the dark forest long months ago. Ever since that bleak time, Abe had been consumed by a desperate desire to know what had happened to his old leader. Word all around Deathlands was the traitor was dead, died in some mystic ceremony with an Apache shaman, died when a woman of 70 summers, who'd been his latest lover, slit his throat when she found him in bed with both her daughter and granddaughter, died when he had faced down an 18-foot mutie grizzly somewhere in the Shens, died when he got bushed by 100 screaming, blood-crazed stickies. All the rumors agreed that he was gone. Then the counter-rumors began. Traitor was alive and running the biggest whorehouse in the world, somewhere around Hawaii or Cuba or Brazil, depending on which story you heard. One of the most insidious and powerful rumors suggested that Traitor headed an unholy alliance, with the steel-eyed Magus, the 350-pound Gert Wolfram at his traveling freak show, Marsh Folsom, Jordan Teague, and his black-clad sec boss from the Nightmareville of Moxon, Court Strasser, and planned to take over the whole of Deathlands. Abe had decided that he couldn't sit around and wait for someone to come along with conclusive proof the traitor was alive or dead, so he'd struck off alone on his quest. Now, within rifle range of the old ruined ville of Seattle, on the edge of the mighty Cascades, he had finally succeeded and was riding again with the traitor. Success. We'll stay around Seattle for 3 months. Come quick, Abe. That had been the message that Traitor had agreed should be sent to Ryan Cotter and the others. Most of the packmen and travelers that Abe had spoken to had agreed to take the message. Some asked for a handful of small change in return for the errand. Nobody knew where Ryan would be, but they were simply told what he looked like. Tall man, well-armed, one-eyed, with a woman whose hair was like spun fire. And they were given descriptions of the rest of the group. Only one person had argued with Abe, pushing the smaller men around, until Traitor walked over from the bar and stood right up in the stranger's face and gave him his thin, dangerous smile and asked if there was a problem. There wasn't. Things were different in ways that Abe found difficult to quantify or understand. All the years when Traitor had ridden the helm of Warwag 1, often with at least one more of the huge armored vehicles in the convoy, Abe had been one of dozens of men and women who'd formed the crews of the Wags. He saw Traitor then for many of his waking hours, and his recollection was of having some good times, long talks, and shared experiences with him. Now he was slowly coming to realize that that was an edited version of the truth. In fact, hardly anyone ever had long conversations with the Traitor, except maybe John Dix and Ryan Cotter, the three men sitting together around the guarded campfires at the end of a day's driving or trading or fighting, talking, occasionally laughing. Abe was now coming to recognize the fact that he'd hardly ever had a long talk with the traitor in his entire life. Maybe never. Now he spent the whole day and long chunks of the night with his taciturn former leader, and it just wasn't at all like he remembered it. Trader was content to go for hours on end without saying a word to Abe, sitting in a chair or with his back against a convenient tree, looking vacantly out across a saloon bar or into the glowing embers at the heart of a dying fire. A few times he would stir and draw out a reminiscence of some firefight or massacre that they'd shared, relishing the way they'd killed their enemies, seeming to Abe to disregard their own fatalities and wounded. The one thing that was like what Abe remembered was Trader's bleak toughness. 2 weeks after they'd finally met up, they were camping on the western ridge of the Cascades. The weather had been variable, often starting with heavens of sunrise, followed by a gradual thickening of the cloud from the Pacific, and then a cold drizzle moving in over the mountains. Trader had bought a bottle of homebrew from a wizened old woman, her eyes almost blind with the pale milk of cataracts. It was so strong that even to flick a few drops from the tips of your fingers into the fire brought a whoosh of flame.
"Remember when those stickies stole a wag full of hard liquor like this, Abe?"
"When was that?"
"Must be 10 years. In the Apps. Scranton. No, wait, it was down Odessa way. Yeah, that was it. Odessa way. We'd camped near a broke freeway bridge."
It rang a vague bell in Abe's memory, and he nodded. Already he'd found that the trader still didn't take kindly to being interrupted or contradicted.
"Yeah.
Drink was so potent that they started spitting it into their big fire. Them stickies surely liked a flame and an explosion. Got them both that night. Some of them kind of exploded when we threw them into the burning wood. Damnedest thing I ever saw, Abe."
Yeah, he remembered all right. Remembered now like it had been that same night. The stickies, there'd been about 15 of them in the raiding gang, had made a try for someone from the Wags. Who had it been? Cone. The radio op had been out fishing in a narrow creek near to sunset. Stickies had come after him. Abe closed his eyes for a moment, his right hand stroking at his long, drooping mustache, visualizing the wounds when Cone had been carried back on a canvas stretcher to the defensive circle in the looming shadows of the two war wags. The unmistakable wounds were from stickies. These were muties that had developed circular suckers on their palms and fingers and used them to hold on to their victims. Cone had the round, raw patches on his arms and one big one on his face, where the layers of skin had been ripped away, leaving the bloody scars like a massive burst blister. Trader had been annoyed. That's like saying that the midday sun could sometimes be fairly warm. Trader's people had gone after the stickies, raiding their camp while they were drinking their stolen moonshine, and killed them all. 15 muties, 8 adult males, 4 women, and 3 children. Most were blasted down from hiding. Trader had never been one to take chances. Survivors were doused in the potent liquor, then burned to death. The charred remains had been left where they'd fallen, after running, burning, and screaming. Abe remembered.
"You're miles away."
Remembering.
"What?"
"Old times past.
Not worth forgetting."
Abe sat up and peered into the depths of his enameled coffee mug, finding, as he'd suspected, that it was almost empty. He tossed the bitter dregs into the dirt and stood to pour himself a top-up from the dark blue pot that hissed and bubbled in the heart of their fire.
"Hold it."
"Shit!"
Abe turned, seeing the glint of metal by his bedroll. His stainless steel Colt Python, the big .357, was as much use there as if it were at the bottom of a Dubuque shithouse.
"Other side of the clearing."
Abe looked where the Armalite pointed, expecting to see a muty rattler, 10 feet long, or a giant cougar, fangs bared, crouched to pounce and crunch and rend him open from groin to breastbone. But it was a gray squirrel, a dainty little creature, quite oblivious to the two men watching it, holding a small pine nut between its front paws and picking at it with quick, delicate movements. Abe turned back, seeing that the trader was cautiously raising the Armalite to his shoulder, squinting along the barrel, steadying it on the tiny squirrel.
"That's a waste of a bullet, trader."
"How's that?"
You used to tell us that a bullet wasted today could be a life wasted tomorrow."
Trader's laugh was loud enough to disturb the creature, sending it scampering away into the lake of tranquil darkness under the trees. To his relief, Abe heard the sound of the safety going back on. His fingers trembling, he helped himself to the hot coffee, sitting down again across from Trader.
You were right, Abe, but I wouldn't cross me too often. 10 weeks for Ryan to get up here. 10 weeks isn't that long.
Despite being only 11 years old, Dean Cotter had been most places in Deathlands and seen most things. But he'd never seen anything like the thing that now sat perched on the back of the rusting locomotive tender, staring at him from golden eyes. There was another on the roof of the stagecoach barn, another squatting up on the splintered gable of the Masonic Lodge, and another, and another. The boy slowly drew his heavy blaster, unsure whether it would be a good idea to start shooting or not, not yet certain whether any of the others had spotted the threat. Then he saw his father, holding the Sig Sauer in his right hand, peering out of the doorway of another of the tumble-down old buildings. Dean saw the expression on his father's face, and knew that meant that he had also seen the sinister creatures that had appeared from out of the shrouding mists.
"Should I chill it, Dad?"
His voice brought the other five into sight, all of them looking up at the apparitions. Ryan waved his hand low, indicating a negative. But the muty thing on the tender still hadn't moved, its eyes boring into Dean with as much passion as a melt-washed boulder of Sierra granite. J.B. waved a clenched fist to Ryan, gesturing toward the general store at the far end of the street of the recreated ghost town. Ryan nodded. The armor's tactical skill hadn't deserted them. The alien creatures might not be hostile, but you didn't take a chance on something like that. It was better to gather in what seemed the strongest of the buildings. Ryan checked that the rest of the companions knew where they were going to go, hefted his blaster, and made sure that his rifle was secure across his shoulders. None of the weird things had moved at all, though five more had arrived, circling lazily from the belt of the fog, settling on other roofs.
Now!
They moved together at the signal, running along the furrowed main street, up onto the splintered, damp boardwalk to the store. Michael was there first, followed closely by Dean and Ryan. All of them stood by the open door, ready to give the others covering fire against the threat of the creatures.
Inside!
They aren't moving, Dad!
The things all watched the flurry of movement with a calm, disinterested stare, the protuberant yellow eyes not seeming to register what was happening. Ryan gestured to Michael and Dean with the Sig Sauer.
In!
He stood and waited. During the last quarter of a minute, a dozen more of the muties had flown in, all finding places to perch on the roofs, all along the strip of buildings. They wheeled down onto Lonesome Gulch in almost total silence. Ryan studied them, trying to weigh up what kind of threat they might present, assuming that they were any sort of danger at all. The more he looked, the more it seemed a fair assumption that the things could be bad news. He guessed that their genetic mutation, triggered by the nuking of 100 years or so ago, had started with some kind of bird. They had a wingspan of about 5 feet, but from what he could see from the doorway, it looked to Ryan as though they didn't have normal avian feathers. There was a metallic, leathery appearance to them, like the wings of robotic bats, with sharp claws spaced out along the leading edge. The jaws were elongated, like an alligator's, with two very prominent curved teeth, and then a myriad of tiny ones. The golden eyes protruded from sockets of bones, and there was a ruff of crimson spikes around the throat. It could have been either feather or bone. None of the things was close enough for Ryan to be able to know for certain. JB reappeared at Ryan's shoulder, holding his Uzi.
They doing anything?
No. What's it look like to defend?
Shutters inside, but they're all rotten. Wouldn't want to trust them to keep out a spitball. The others are putting them up now. They got obslits in them.
Fog's coming lower again.
Now there were about 50 of the bird creatures. Every now and again, one of those farthest away would flap into the air and make an ungainly landing on a closer roof.
We hold out here until night. Can't be that long now. Move out then and head for the redoubt. You know, the gateway. Unless those ugly sons of bitches can see in the dark.
Behind them, they could hear the old shutters easing into position.
More of those birds out front, near where that parking lot used to be.
How many?
10 or 12.
What are they doing?
Watching. Don't like this one, lover. Could be we ought to head out of here, as soon as we can.
They're getting restless. Only trouble in trying to reach the Mattrans unit in the dark is that we don't have a working compass, and those fogs can be a bastard.
J.B. rested his Uzi against his hip and took off his wire-rimmed spectacles, polishing them on a kerchief.
Thought of getting lost in this place is...
Here they come!
The mist had grown suddenly thicker, sinking from the barren peaks around onto the small ville as though it were a hostile, sentient entity itself. At the precise moment that the creatures began to shriek, the things rose from the roofs and flapped toward the store. Dean had been watching through the narrow slit in one of the shutters that overlooked the street.
They're all in the air, and the fog's badder than... They're coming in toward... They're circling, Dad! Hundreds of them!
Ryan looked around the store, all of his experience and combat sense working overtime. The room was around 30 feet long by 20 wide, with several windows, all of them now covered with the interior shutters. The front entrance was glass, but it had a thick wire inner door.
Get something against that, Michael.
Things that big could break through the screen. Help him, Doc.
What with?
The countertop.
There's enough stairs, Ryan.
Ryan turned on his heel and stared through the gloom at Mildred, who was pointing along a narrow passage that ran back from the near cash register and the display cabinet holding the sacks of blasting powder.
Fire blast.
Ryan sprinted along the corridor toward the steep, narrow staircase, dropping his rifle as he ran to give himself greater speed and mobility. Before he'd even set his foot on the steps, he heard it ahead and above
him. JB! Upstairs!
Ryan reached the landing and glanced to left and right. He saw that there was a single gable room at the far end, the door standing a little ajar. There hadn't been many times in Ryan Cutter's life where he'd been consciously frightened of anything. Yet that shadowy landing, with the half-open door at its end, containing those hideous creatures, made him hesitate for a moment. But common sense carried him on. If the things escaped from that upstairs room, then there was nothing to be done to prevent them from flooding down into the main part of the store. And the dying wasn't likely to take very long. Ryan knew JB was right behind him on the rickety wooden steps. At the farther end, a reptilian head appeared in the gap, unwinking ochre eyes burning through the gloom. Ryan snapped shot, missed by inches, gouging a spray of plaster from the wall. The thing was out, its huge wings cramped by the narrow passage, its beak open. Ryan batted at it with the barrel of his gun, hitting it a glancing blow across the chest, barely dodging a scything jab from the fanged beak.
Chill it, JB! I'll close the door!
Ryan grabbed at the dark metal handle, shaped like the head of a buffalo, and tugged at it. But another of the muties had found the gap and was blocking it. Ryan held the door in his left hand, the Sig Sauer in his right. He reacted like lightning, dropping the gun at his feet and drawing the panga from its greased sheath. The blade blurred through the dusty air, striking the muty bird just below the point where its angular skull articulated with its snake-like neck. Ryan had expected the honed steel to slice clear through, but the panga angled off, barely nicking the overlapping scales. The narrow head struck again at him, the point of its beak ripping at his sleeve, nearly making him let go of the door handle.
Need a hand, Ryan?
No room. Fucker's got a skin like set steel.
Two more desperate hacking blows had more success, opening a gouge in the thing's throat, sending drops of amber blood pattering hot and acid onto Ryan's wrist. He took a chance and eased the door open a few inches, punching with the haft of the panga at the wounded creature, pushing it back into the attic room. Until that moment, it had never occurred to Ryan that there might not be any sort of catch on the door, or that it could easily have rusted away during the endless years after the long winters. He spun around, stooping with an easy grace to retrieve his fallen Sig Sauer, seeing that JB was standing at the top of the stairs, Uzi at the ready. The dead muty bird was lying still on the dusty floor, one wing broken off, its head lolling on its muscular neck. JB smiled at Ryan, his teeth white in the gloom.
Door won't hold him long. Never figured on ending as a bird's dinner.
As Ryan ran back down the stairs into the main part of the old store, he was figuring that JB was probably right. It looked as though it were only going to be a matter of time. It was like being at the still center of a spinning world. Outside, there was a cacophony of shrieking noise, orchestrated by the constant thudding of wings and beaks battering at the walls and shutters. The other five were standing close together by the candy counter, guns drawn, waiting for the moment when the defenses were breached and the muty creatures poured in to kill them.
Any ideas?
Yeah!
What?
Can I have some candy? Then I'll tell you!
For a moment, Ryan nearly slapped the boy. That he could joke at a time of such imminent peril brought the crimson mist of rage flooding down across Ryan's mind. Christy, at his side, caught the wave of potential violence from Ryan and gripped him by the wrist, very hard. She didn't let go of Ryan while she spoke.
Tell us, Dean. Then have as much candy as you want.
The heavy counter that had been propped against the wire screen over the front entrance to the store was already rocking under the impact of the things. Dean pointed back toward the stairs.
There's a root cellar under there!
JB was closest, and he moved with deceptive speed, opening a dark-painted door.
Throw us a pack of self-lights, if they still work.
Mildred picked up a box of matches and threw them to the armorer, who vanished from their sight.
Cellar, all right. Solid. And reckon we can get out of here. Double doors. Yeah, they're stiff. There's something piled on them, but we can shift them. Definitely another way out.
But those shithead snakebird things are all the way around us.
If only we could find some way of luring them all in here and then destroy them with some fiendishly cunning ruse.
Dean was leaning against one of the remaining counters, sucking pensively on a honey and mango sugar stick, tossing one of the little souvenir bags of blasting powder in the air with his other hand.
Careful that doesn't blow us all up. That's it. JB, come here. Something you once showed me.
The trick Trader taught me, first week after I joined him.
JB was down on his knees, oblivious to the threat from the muted birds flocked all around them. Ryan had just snatched a glance from one of the obslits, and realized then that time was sliding away from them. The fog had closed in, and there seemed to be literally hundreds upon hundreds of the vicious brutes. The temperature had also dropped radically in the past few minutes, so that everyone could see their breath misting around them in the store.
Damnably chill. My Aunt Harriet used to have a saying that it was as cold as the blood in the neck of a dead horse.
Ryan ignored Doc. The seconds were running out, the sand falling ever faster through the thin glass throat of the timer. And the delicate operation he and JB were working on could possibly save all of their lives. Or destroy them a few minutes more quickly. He had taken a handful of thin black cigarillos from a sealed pack on the counter, making sure with the self-lights that they still worked and hadn't dried away to powder. He carefully got them all glowing evenly at the same length and bound them upright with a length of thin twine from one of JB's capacious pockets. Then he set them amid a pile of wood shavings that Michael had whittled from the edge of one of the shutters, along with a number of crumpled dry pages from some of the old guides. The main trigger for the ignition was a number of matches, tilted carefully against the pile of small cigars, so that they would eventually come into contact with the glowing ends.
As nice a little fire booby trap as I ever saw. All we need now is a trail of black powder from the source to the main stock of the explosive.
Dean slipped up the stairs and ran down again almost immediately.
The bastards have almost broken through! One of the top panels is split from top to bottom, and I can see their beaks driving clean through!
Right. Take some self-lights and go down in the cellar. Everyone except me and JB now.
To Ryan's relief, they all obeyed immediately. Christy brushing the tips of her fingers against his cheek as she left.
Don't be too long, lover.
JB had scattered a trail of the glistening black grains, leading to the main store of the powder, which he'd packed tightly into a stout wooden box that had been standing in a corner of the store.
Nearly ready.
Where did you first get this idea from?
A guy in Oregon got paid to spot fires for the local baron. Paid Jack on results. More fires he spotted, more Jack he got. Took to starting them himself. Showed me how he did it.
Ryan glanced one last time through the nearest obslit, looking out across the main street. The muties were attacking in a ceaseless stream. JB turned toward the passage that led to the stairs into the root cellar.
We need them in here for the explosion to work. Kill enough for us to be able to risk a break.
Dark night. You're right, Ryan.
Go. I'll pull down that old counter. Should give them a way in. Might have time to throw open one or two of the shutters as well.
They're in!
JB ran to knock over the counter, while Ryan unbolted two of the pairs of shutters. The muty horrors held off for a vital couple of seconds, suspicious of the sudden access to the old store. JB led the way toward the door at the top of the basement steps, held open by a watchful Christy. Ryan was less than 6 feet behind him, still holding the Uzi, the Sig Sauer in its holster. The Steyr had been taken down to safety by Dean. Death was all around. Boiling down the stairs from the second story, the creatures clashed with each other in their bloodlust, their beaks open. Others had surged in through the shattered front entrance and past the open shutters. Ryan felt something pluck at his sleeve, and there was a sharp, fiery pain at the side of his neck, warmth running down inside his collar. JB was through the door. Christie's face, a taut mask of fear, was framed in the rectangular shadow. Ryan paused a second, the blaster on full auto, spraying a circle of bloody doom all around him, seeing the muted birds falling with shattered wings and broken skulls. Then he was through the door, and Christy slammed it shut, pushing across stout bolts at the bottom and top.
Fucking close, lover.
Below them was a set of stairs without a handrail that led down into an earth-walled cellar about 15 feet square. Five faces looked up at Ryan, illuminated by the orange glow of the brief self-lights that everyone but JB was holding.
Let's get right down. Cover your ears and open your mouths.
The door at the top of the stairs was taking a dreadful pounding, but that wasn't what concerned Ryan. The passage was so narrow that no more than a couple of the things could attack the sturdy wood. It was the bomb, they said, that worried Ryan. He was worried what would happen if it didn't go off, and what would happen if it did go off. If it didn't, the creatures would get them, either by breaking down the door, or eventually by waiting them out. If it went off as planned, then it should kill or mutilate the majority of the attacking muties and scare the living hell out of any survivors, giving Ryan and the others a decent chance to break for it and head back for the gateway, providing that the explosion didn't wreck the store so effectively that the cellar roof collapsed and the entire place entombed them. Working in the near dark under enormous pressure with 100-year-old black blasting powder didn't lead to the scientific probability of measured success. On balance, Ryan hoped that it went off. One by one, the tiny halos of light from the matches were extinguished, leaving the cellar in pitch darkness. Everyone was crouched over on hands and knees, palms pressed to their ears, mouths sagging open against the anticipated shockwave.
Hasn't worked, Dad.
Can't tell yet, Dean. It's not like a cron time to grin.
This brings back such happy memories of playing at sardines with my English cousins at one Christmas party. One had to squeeze into the smallest, darkest space one could find and wait for the other to try to find you.
How long do you reckon, JB?
I reckon in the next minute or...
Or what, John?
Or not at all.
It's coming.
When?
Soon, Mother, very soon. Now!
The floor heaved, and Ryan felt chunks of wood and dirt raining over him as he crouched on the packed earth. JB was quickest, holding a dozen spluttering matches in his hand. The air was filled with powdery dust, and they could all catch the bitter stench of the explosive. Christy touched a finger to her nose, bringing it away streaked with crimson. Dean had a worm of blood creeping from his nose, and Doc spat blood from where he'd bitten his tongue. Ryan scrambled to his feet, feeling his head ringing.
Ugh. Can't hear those muty birds anymore.
Ugh, I can't hear anything.
No point waiting.
Ryan walked to the heavy cellar doors and braced himself under them.
Dean, take the rifle and Uzi. Michael and JB, lend a hand here.
Doc, Mildred, and Christy struck more matches, giving the men enough light to see what they were doing. For a frozen moment, Ryan thought that they might not be able to shift the ancient doors, and was on the verge of asking Christy to use the power of the Earth Mother, even though he knew what a terrible toll it took out of her when calling on that frightful strength.
It's going!
Finally, both doors swung up and back, letting in a flood of cold, bitter fog. Outside the building, the day hadn't yet quite run its course, though it was moving toward evening.
A ladder? No. Michael, climb out first. Here, I'll give you a leg up. Then you help pull everyone out.
The place was deathly still, the fog clamped tight around, cutting visibility to less than 5 paces as they escaped from the back of the store. Behind them, there was the dimly seen light of a fire burning, dry wood crackling, but no sign of the muty creatures.